Welcome to the 11th episode of the Scottish Housing News podcast. And this time we're looking at poverty and inequality, what housing associations can do about it, and we're also going to be looking at some of the real-life effects that people in the trade see when they deal with families, do casework, the real-life situations that people face. And with us, to help us with that, is Kirsty McKechnie. She's the project manager for the Early Warning System project at Child Poverty Action Group Scotland. And we've got the Director of Policy and Membership at the Scottish Federation of Housing Associations, Aaron Hill. And so, let's start with you, Aaron. Is poverty and inequality important to housing associations, or is it just about collecting the rent for you?
Solving and tackling poverty and inequality is at the core purpose of what housing associations do. And I think it's really important that we continue to see capital investment in social housing as part of the solution to poverty. And I think for too long, that hasn't been the case. When you look at some of the statistics on poverty across Scotland and compare them with the rest of the UK, actually, despite the real challenge that we face, child poverty and overall poverty are lower in Scotland than they are in England and Wales. And that is as a direct result of lower housing costs. So we know that housing costs have a significant impact. I get frustrated when people talk about food poverty and fuel poverty and lots of other things, because poverty is poverty and they are all symptoms of people not having enough money. So there's lots of work that goes on in that space through kind of preventative support around tenancy sustainment, helping people to access food banks and food pantries, things like that, support around fuel poverty. But it's absolutely at the core of what we do.
And Kirsty, you started earlier on in your career as a welfare rights worker with Link Housing Association before you moved to the Child Poverty Action Group. Maybe you had some things in between, I don't know. What's your impression of the way that housing associations and poverty interact?
I started off, as you say, with Link, and I was looking at the allocations and the number of people who were coming to Link to apply for housing because they couldn't afford housing anywhere else. And it became really obvious how much of an impact benefits had on people's ability to pay the rent, that social security was such a huge issue. And it's just so important. Housing associations have such a huge role to play in terms of tackling poverty and income maximisation. There's so many housing associations doing really positive work in terms of things like welfare rights workers, tenancy sustainment officers. These roles are absolutely vital. The housing associations have a huge role to play here.
Now, with me in the studio, as always, is Kieran Finlay, the editor of the Scottish Housing News. Kieran.
Hi, Kirsty. What is the Early Warning System project?
Thanks for asking that. It was set up in 2013 in response to all the changes that were coming to the social security system. So I monitor all of the queries that come into Child Poverty Action Group in Scotland's advice line for second-tier advisors. I also get case studies direct from frontline workers, and it's about the impact of social security and changes and how the social security system operates on families and the communities that support them. And through that, we can see that a lot of the time social security is having an impact on people's ability to pay rent. Sometimes it's a direct impact through universal credit housing costs, but sometimes it could be an indirect impact through other problems with the benefit system, then leaving people without enough income to pay their rent.
And is this a trend that you've seen more of, like the past 6 months to a year?
Yes, I would say in terms of the last 6 months to a year, one of the things that's come up a lot has been in relation to, it's quite a niche problem, but in relation to people who've maybe been held on remand, who can't get their housing costs paid for a longer period of time in prison, might get it up for 6 months on remand. But what we're seeing is people have been held on remand for longer than that because of the COVID pandemic. And then that's causing an issue for people then leaving prison and leaving with rent arrears. So we sometimes pick up like what might be seen as quite a discrete issue, but we also see sort of larger, more systematic issues with universal credit in relation to housing costs and lots of people being underpaid or overpaid, or their housing element not being added correctly, and that causing real difficulties for people in paying their rent.
Does that cause real difficulties for housing associations, Aaron, if people can't pay their rent, often because of some bureaucratic problem with whatever agency they're involved with?
The benefit system is a kind of perennial frustration, I think, for all social landlords. And I was reflecting when you're talking about kind of the start of Kirsty's career there on the role that welfare rights advisors play in housing associations. And I was talking to Berwickshire Housing Association just a couple of weeks ago, and they were saying that in the last financial year, people in those roles brought in more than £1 million of additional income to their tenants. So I think it's complex for housing associations, and we have frustrations with the DWP, we have frustrations with the system. I mean, the latest example of that is the way in which rents are verified when a rental increase happens during the financial year. So now a housing association has to verify in every single rent increase that a tenant puts through the universal credit system, which creates huge bureaucracy. And potentially, if a tenant's entered the wrong data, or if that message doesn't come through to a housing association, potentially delay that payment. So it's frustrating for housing associations, but I think that's almost a second-order question. It's much more frustrating for the people claiming it, and can potentially be, you know, catastrophic and damaging for those people. We've seen the delays in universal credit rollout. We've seen the sanctions that are implemented often unfairly. You know, there are many cases of successful appeal. There are many cases of those appeals going further. And I think what we see is just an inherent unfairness built into the welfare system, where people are being expected to live on not enough money. And we need to get much better at challenging that. I've been really frustrated with the cost of living crisis that's ongoing at the moment, really frustrated. There are UK government ministers out there talking about what a great success the council tax rebate that they've made is. And, you know, clearly Scottish government have followed that. The politics almost forced them to. But talking about how they've used an existing mechanism to get money into people's pockets. There's an existing mechanism in universal credit, and we're not using it. That really important uplift that we saw to people's incomes during the COVID pandemic has gone. The subsequent uplift is nowhere near that, and is nowhere near inflation. So in real terms, people are being expected to live off less money than they were last year. The poorest people in society, the people who need help. And that, I mean, you can probably hear a little bit of the passion coming through in my voice. It makes a lot of people really angry, and rightly so. But we need to get more effective at challenging that.
Child Poverty Action Group, Kirsty, has been challenging benefit decisions. That's been bread and butter to that organisation for many decades. Is there any possibility of structural change? I mean, does the government listen to you now when you put out policy papers?
There's sort of different areas of challenge. So obviously we have a legal team down in London carrying out lots of legal challenges. And I think that can be a frustration maybe to the government sometimes that they'd rather we didn't do that. We are engaging with DWP at a national level, but also at a kind of Scottish level. I would say our relationship with DWP in Scotland has been quite good in terms of flagging up. I was talking about those early warning system case studies, and we go along with examples of where things have gone wrong so that we can have a look back at the system and see what improvements might be made. That said, it's taken a long time to build up that relationship, and that is generally tinkering around the edges in terms of practice rather than having that kind of wholesale change to policy that's required in order to make sure that people have enough money in their pockets.
And I'm interested to know if Social Security Scotland, which is the new agency on the scene, is providing more resource and useful things, or if they're just providing another layer of complexity. Either of you.
It's definitely added another layer of complexity to the social security system. We're now in the space where people can be claiming benefits from HMRC, child benefit, for example, universal credit, and other benefits from DWP, and then other benefits for children or benefits for disability from Social Security Scotland. And a lot of these intertwine with each other, so you need to notify. If you've got one benefit, you need to notify a different agency that you've received this benefit to, in order to receive another bit of benefit from one of the other agencies. And the onus is very much at the moment on the applicant and the claimant to know which benefits to claim, who to claim them for, who to notify of what change at any given time. And I say Social Security Scotland are more responsive to conversations we've had with them about this additional layer of complexity and how can this be minimised, and the notion that we really do want to see a much more smooth system, so it doesn't matter who somebody goes to, that all of these conversations can be held behind the scene, but it shouldn't fall to the claimant to have to sort that out for themselves, because that's where people start to fall through the net and that's where people don't get the money that they're entitled to.
Aaron, moving back to rents, we are speaking in April, and that's typically the month in which housing associations, well, they've finished the rent calculations, but they now begin to implement them for the year ahead. Given the issues we've been speaking about, what advice did you give to your members?
I think, Kieran, it's not for me to give advice to our members. I think we provide them the support and tools to make those decisions, but ultimately those are decisions that individual businesses need to make. Every chief exec and every finance director I spoke to at Housing Association during the rent setting process this year said it was the hardest rent decision they've ever made. I think the first thing I would start by saying is you know, clearly rent is the most important and biggest income stream that comes into a social landlord. And therefore, the decision as a business that you make on rent each year is massive, but it doesn't just impact in that year. So decisions that you make on rent this year, for example, if you were to choose to freeze your rent this year, would have a compounding effect over the 30 years of your business plan and potentially impacts on your ability to maintain homes, to develop homes during that period and to provide other services. So I think where we've landed is that I think that the average rent increase we've seen from the members that have spoken to us and that responded to our surveys will be about 3.1% this year. So that's around where September inflation is. It tends to be September inflation that housing associations will use as their measure. It's significantly below where real inflation is now. And I think that the key thing that we need to do when it comes to rent is define what we mean by affordability, though. Rent isn't the only housing cost. And, you know, the cost of energy is spiraling. Council tax inevitably will come under pressure again because we know that services continue to be under pressure at a local level. And we need to be able to build a full picture of all of the things tenants are paying when we make those decisions. And that's what we've tried to do with our members through our affordability tool. We try to give them that information so that they can kind of balance those decisions. And I think that means that rents do remain affordable and do remain low in Scotland. But I don't think that conversation on rent is going to get any easier next year. As I said, people told me it was the hardest one they've had to make this year. I don't think it gets any easier next year. If you look at where inflation is going, I've seen figures this morning of price increases in construction of kind of 50 and 60% again over the last 2 to 3 months on some materials. That's not going away. The cost of living crisis means, as you say, wages will need to increase. And then you've got the double whammy of kind of national insurance increases for employers as well. So there's a lot to balance. And ultimately, housing associations are putting tenants first, but that will have long-term consequences. And we do need to think about how we balance those things.
The question of affordability is really tricky, and I don't have the answer. I just have questions, really. I know that RSLs need the money, need their income in order to be able to run the housing association, to pay their staff, to carry out maintenance, to carry out repairs. And I know that when we see RSL rents, they are much lower and considered affordable in relation to the private market. But what we are seeing in some occasions now is that some individuals, particularly individuals in receipt of some social security, if they're not receiving full housing costs through universal credit, if they're not receiving full housing benefit, then that property is not affordable. And I think at what point do we have to look at what the tension between what keeps housing associations running and what impact does that have on individuals, and how do we sort that out? And I like I say, I genuinely don't have the answer, but I don't think we can just look at, well, we're affordable in relation to the private rented sector. At some point we're going to have to look at the impact with individuals. And one of the reasons I say this is at the moment the bedroom tax and benefit cap are being mitigated by discretionary housing payments. In future, we're going to expect fewer people to be affected by the benefit cap, but they'll be affected by the two-child limit instead. But that will mean that some families have got a much lower income without any obvious route to mitigate how they then pay their rent, and I think that's something that we're storing up and we need to think about and how we look at.
I just want to pick up on a couple of things Kirsty said there, because I think that the kind of the test against the market, you're probably right, is not the right one. Saying that we're affordable compared to the private rented sector doesn't mean anything to the person who can't afford to pay their social rent. You know, rightly, housing associations are scrutinised on their rental decisions, and we scrutinise ourselves very heavily and engage our tenants to do that process too. But we don't talk anywhere near enough about the fact that wages have basically stagnated over 10 years at the bottom end of the labour market. We don't talk anywhere near enough about the fact that, I've tried today a little bit, but we don't talk anywhere near enough about the fact that universal credit doesn't go up enough each year. And so the bit of the equation that we do need to get a bit more savvy about talking about as a housing sector and need to think about how we influence is how we increase people's income. How do we make sure that universal credit is sufficient for people to live on? How do we make sure that work genuinely pays? Because when we talk about poverty, often now the people who are living in poverty are people who are in work, because work doesn't pay enough to cover those costs of living. And I think we need to raise our voices on that. We need to be promoting good work as a sector. We need to be thinking about the money that people bring in. And on the housing association kind of viability end of that dynamic as well, you know, you're right, Kirsty. And I think we need to acknowledge that the way out of this bind, if people's incomes don't change, the way out of this bind is government funding. And government, the amount of grants the government pays to develop homes, and let's not get into decarbonisation and the cost of energy efficiency measures today, but the amount of funding that will be available for that as well will have a direct knock-on effect on the amount of rent that is paid, because the rest of the money is coming from private finance and that has to be paid for in some way, and generally that's coming through rental income. So if we're going to have this conversation and this pressure from government to make sure that rents remain affordable, and we can't do anything about income because we haven't got those levers, then the only lever we've got is grant funding and capital to make sure that those rents stay lower or go lower. And I think sometimes government doesn't always acknowledge that trade-off and just need to be aware of it, particularly with costs rising at the moment.
In COVID, we found a simple solution to preventing the eviction of tenants for rent arrears. The Scottish Government just said, you can't do it, so stop it. But maybe that's not completely sustainable. So what is the practical answer? Are there any policy ideas floating around in the ether that are being discussed which could actually prevent the eviction of people who are, I'm not talking about antisocial behaviour, I'm not talking about tenants who beat each other up, I'm talking about people who just simply can't afford to pay their rent and have come to that point where all the benefits have been claimed and, you know, there still isn't enough and they have to go. So what are the policy ideas that would enable us to prevent that happening?
I think the first thing I'd say to that is that social landlords have made a commitment not to evict tenants who are struggling to pay their rent, but trying to do so or engaging with us. And those are really important principles. And I think you're right to define kind of antisocial behaviour, domestic abuse, those sorts of things, because it is important there are measures in place to be able to deal with that. When it comes to those who can't or don't pay their rent, there's a huge amount of kind of focus on prevention work. There is, you know, work to prevent homelessness, support to access benefits we've talked about. Ultimately, the challenge that we've got around evictions is there is a shortage of homes. And those people who live in social housing, who pay their rent, will ultimately be the ones who suffer if we aren't able to bring rental income in. In the rare instance where we do evict people because of rent arrears, what we need to make sure is those people aren't being evicted into homelessness. And that means a whole public service approach to ensuring that people threatened with homelessness are given the support that they need, making sure that there's temporary accommodation available, making sure that there are wraparound support services. And so the work that the government are doing at the moment on kind of rapid rehousing and on Housing First are positive steps in that direction. And the proposals that are being consulted on at the moment for a prevention of homelessness duty across public services means that people will be much, much more engaged in this, I hope, across public services. At the moment, it's seen as a housing problem, and it's not just a housing problem.
And Kirsty, you've already said that you don't have the answer to this, but that won't stop me asking you. Have you got any ideas about what could now be done to prevent? I mean, thinking of that situation where somebody has actually come to the end of the road, something that Aaron said, you know, if they've engaged with us, well, a lot of people who get into these situations will not engage, and it might well be that if they had engaged, the thing might have been stopped. Let's just face facts, a lot of people don't engage and end up being evicted. What can you do, or from your side of the tracks, an agency that's there specifically to represent and help claimants, what can you do to try and make sure that doesn't happen?
Coming back to what Aaron was saying about homelessness prevention, one of the things that we're doing, and we responded to the Prevention of Homelessness consultation, was about this wider public duty and recognising that sometimes parents are really scared to ask for help in relation to their income, particularly from the local authority, and it might be from the housing association as well, because they really worry about how their ability to parent will be perceived. I've not got enough money, I can't be a good parent. We're finding that more and more people will have conversations with trusted partners, such as their health visitor, maybe somebody at a school. And we're trying to make sure that people who are not traditional benefit specialists are equipped with just enough knowledge to be able to say, do you know that there might be somewhere that you can go to for help? Do you know that there's somewhere that you can get advice and support with this, and to try and remove any kind of stigma that there might be for people seeking advice, to try and go that kind of step much further back. Because I think once you get into rent arrears, it's much harder to get out of them. If you've got a really, really low income, it's one thing to cover your basic necessities. It's a whole different thing to then have to be able to try and make additional payments to something like rent arrears on top of that. I think we've welcomed recently the Scottish Government's commitment to work on the mitigation of the benefit cap through discretionary housing payments. I think that was one of our areas of real concern in relation to being able to pay rent, that people who were experiencing the benefit cap, a lot of people were in the social rented sector, there was nowhere cheaper for them to move to. And so that the only response to that really was to try and provide some kind of funding from somewhere to make sure that people could continue to pay their rents, and hopefully that'll happen on a wider basis through discretionary housing payments. We know that that was happening in a lot of instances, but it wasn't necessarily happening everywhere. The nature of discretionary housing payments being that they are discretionary, and we're putting pressure on Scottish Government at the moment to introduce new guidance. It's urgently needed for local authorities in terms of administrating that, to make sure that there's a more consistent approach across local authorities.
I think that point around non-engagement is a really important one as well, because I mean, anybody who's been in any kind of financial trouble or behind on any payments will know how hard that phone call is, or that conversation is with the people that you owe money to. And so it's not always an easy conversation for a tenant to reach out to the housing association. But a lot of that support that is provided is done so in partnership. And actually the solution to a lot of this is partnership working. So housing associations working with local organisations like CPAG, like citizens advice agencies, like Shelter, so that there is independent advice available as well, so that taking that first step is a little bit less scary and might help in kind of getting the person to a point of engaging with the housing association.
Another consultation responded to by the Child Poverty and Action Group Scotland was in August 2019, Kirsty, and it was to do with temporary accommodation standards. Is that something that you were involved with yourself?
It's ringing bells.
let me take you back. The charity suggested that guidance, the issue was that evidence submitted to the early warning system highlighted that people who are subject to the benefit cap are often unable to afford their temporary accommodation. And the charity suggested that, you know, there should be guidance out there to ensure clients are placed in accommodation which avoids or minimises any shortfall between the housing benefit and the rent that's been charged, and that there was advice and assistance there for people to request discretionary housing payments. This was 2.5 years ago. Is this something that we've talked there about partnership working? As far as you're concerned, have there been improvements in this area since then?
In some senses, yes. I think in relation to temporary accommodation, there are more people who are receiving housing benefit for the temporary accommodation costs and universal credit for their living costs. The universal credit can be capped, the housing benefit not if it's temporary accommodation. So that in a way has become an improvement. But in relation to the operation of discretionary housing payments, I was thinking about, you know, when did the benefit cap come in? how long ago is that? And this is us just getting a commitment to mitigate now from Scottish Government. That's been a long period of time. That's been a lot of uncertainty for families. We know that some people will have been refused discretionary housing payments in the past. We have examples of that through the early warning system. We have examples of local authorities operating differently. And I think that's why we're still saying this guidance is so urgently needed. And we have one example of a family who are in temporary accommodation at the moment, who their temporary accommodation has been paid for by the housing benefit, but the benefit cap in their universal credit is £750. It's been reduced by £750 already. When they move to a housing association property, they're not going to get any more income, but they're not going to get the rent paid for them either, because the housing benefit will stop. And so this is where those discretionary housing payments that are coming in are just so vital for people. And we really welcome that commitment for them to be mitigated.
Alan, the cost of temporary accommodation provided by councils is mind-boggling, and it's been a real problem, and I wonder if all of those rents are ever actually paid unless you can get full housing benefit for them. Is there nothing that housing associations can do? Is there any really good practice example that you can quote of a housing association that provides really strong support to a local authority in dealing with homeless people?
There are multiple kind of emerging responses to homelessness, and we're learning a lot from places like Finland and across the continent, where I think what we're learning, the reliance on temporary accommodation has been the wrong one probably for quite a long time, and the costs of providing that are extreme, and housing benefit is a key factor in it. What we're moving towards is kind of a much more stable provision of home with the right of a home with the right support wrapped around it. So the work that Queen's Cross Housing Association do, and they have a kind of family support initiative where the support is very family targeted, and most of the families in that are kind of single parent families, so have significant kind of complications to be dealing with in terms of relationships and domestic abuse and all of those sorts of things. And it ranges right the way from kind of benefits advice all the way through to pastoral care, helping people get into work, identifying the things that will make that family successful and will make that family kind of be able to survive. It's quite similar to a Housing First model, but much more targeted in terms of the audience that it's trying to reach there. And there are hundreds of examples of projects like that across Scotland. I think when Kirsty was talking there, the transition is the really difficult bit from temporary accommodation. And for many people, kind of moving into a new housing association property is for the first time might be difficult. And what we need to make sure is that the support's in place. The vulnerability of discretionary housing payments is in the name, if they are discretionary. And again, this comes back to the two key things I've talked about really today. The shortage of housing in the first instance. That's why people are ending up in temporary accommodation. We simply don't have enough stable, empty homes to be able to provide people. And the weakness of the benefit system, that we are reliant on discretionary housing payments rather than payments that will be paid automatically to make sure people can pay their rent.
I'm going to say something slightly odd here. I'm going to say thermoplastic tiles. The reason I'm saying thermoplastic tiles is I remember moving into a council house in Muirhouse long ago, and it had thermoplastic tiles on the floor, so I didn't immediately need to buy any floor coverings. And that's one of the things which is a problem for homeless people when they move into a housing association or a council flat, is if it's just bare floorboards, and it often is, then how do they actually get those covered? And the whole furniture thing as well is a big problem for people at that point of crisis in their lives when they may well have been left with nothing. I'm sure Ukrainian refugees are going to find that too as they arrive in Scotland and are rehoused. What can we do to make it easier for people to move into a house? And that can involve physical things, but Kirsty, you've also talked about that period at the beginning of a tenancy when you might not have got your finances straightened out either, and there is that risk of abandonment because you don't have the furniture or you don't have the money to maintain your house.
The issue we see there is that people are asked to sign up to a tenancy, and I know that the housing associations are under great pressure to make sure that their void periods are as low as possible, and then a tenant might sign up for their tenancy but still have a 4-week overlap from the tenant. They still have to pay for the temporary accommodation, or they still have to give notice somewhere else. And we see delays with community care grants. If people are applying for community care grants from the local authority for help with floor coverings or furniture, things like that, you know, if it's not processed for a couple of weeks, then that's time where somebody feels that they can't move into their property. And sometimes benefit doesn't start until you've actually moved in. And again, that's an area where people need advice to sort of move in, say that you've moved in, you know, stay overnight, that's you, you're in, to get the housing cost started off. But there used to be in housing benefit a 4-week overlap that you could have if there was an unavoidable overlap, and that doesn't exist in universal credit in the same way. So I think the beginning of those tenancies is a real issue in terms of people having the necessary things to set themselves up, but also so that they don't start off in rent arrears, which we sometimes see, that just to make sure that, and again, it's not something I necessarily have the answer for, but it's something that I would like to see discussed and sorted out if possible.
Yeah, the benefits angle is an interesting one, because I think housing associations, as we move towards universal credit, housing associations have tried to kind of show discretion and understanding, because the system means that the money's not going to be going in at the point at which a tenant moves in. When it comes to furniture and flooring, this is where I could get in trouble for this. but this is one where I just think social landlords need to get a bit sharper at it. And I think lots of housing associations are waking up to the fact that if you're not providing flooring or certain types of furniture when somebody moves in and they then abandon the property or don't pay their rent as a result of that, it's a false economy. And the saving that you might make in doing so is not in fact a saving. And so we're seeing more housing associations, particularly on flooring. I think it's become a particularly contentious issue. Prior to working in Scotland, I worked for the Welsh Trade Body, Community Housing Cymru, and there was a piece of work done in Wales by TPAS in Wales on flooring, and it was a real kind of wake-up moment for the sector on the impact that was having. And what often happened is for those tenants who weren't provided with flooring when they moved in, it wasn't sorted within 3 weeks. It was often remained that case for 6, 12, 18 months. That has knock-on effect in terms of the maintenance of that home, in terms of the warmth of that home, and continues to kind of spiral in those ways. And we know that the experiences of tenants who move into homes with carpet, with flooring, are much, much better. The outcomes are much, much better. So I think it's something we just need to get better at when it comes to flooring in particular. Furniture is probably a little bit more kind of personal, and I think that the partnership approach is key here. So we are seeing really good local partnerships where housing associations are working with social enterprises who might be reusing furniture, bringing things back into use, or can provide packages at really low costs.
There are some housing associations who are already doing this stuff, that are doing it brilliantly, you know, really getting things right. And I think what we want to see is much more of that good practice just becoming widespread. When we talk to housing associations, there are different things that we'll pick up and be like, that's amazing, I wish everybody did that. You know, we would, in terms of, you know, the beginning of tenancies and people moving in, things like people coming out of hospital and making sure that people who are maybe returning home from hospital have things like the, you know, they've got some money. If you might be returned home from hospital and not have enough money but not be able to get to the bank or the post office, to make sure that the heating and the electricity are in place. You know, these things are brilliant. And just the more we can see of good practice being mainstreamed, the so much better it'll be for everybody. But again, I understand that there's constraints with that as well.
The one that jumps out is Melville Housing Association. It was one of the ones I saw when I moved to Scotland, where it was inspired by tenant activity, actually. Tenants pointed out the challenges with moving into homes without floors, and they've engaged in a kind of reuse project. So they've worked, I think, with Zero Waste Scotland and a couple of other organisations to reuse flooring tiles that previously would have been used in office accommodation or elsewhere, have those cleaned up, and then they're fitted, and you don't have that problem when people move in. So I think that's a good example. There are plenty others out there, but it's about sharing that good practice, and it's about understanding why that's worked for that organisation, how it might be applicable elsewhere.
I think there's loads of examples that housing associations have proven that if you put the money in the right hands and provide targeted support, that they will do good things with it. One of these recently was the Social Housing Fuel Support Fund. I know it's administered by the SFHA on behalf of the Scottish Government. There's particularly good things going on in Fife with Oare Valley Housing Association, amongst others. How successful has this been, and what other initiatives are out there?
I mean, firstly, I think we're incredibly grateful to Scottish Government and to ministers for spotting that issue and for working with SFHA to get that money out. We started with a £2 million pot. Demand was enormous, unsurprisingly, and we ended up spending, I think, just shy of £2.5 million to our members. The approaches taken really kind of vary. So I think Lucchese were an example where they kind of gave fuel vouchers direct to all of their tenants as a result of the funding that we distributed to them. Others put it into advice services, and others have kind of explored how they can best make an impact in terms of people's energy bills, whether that's through switching services or collective buy-in, those sorts of things. The impact, from what I see, is enormous, but I need to caveat that with we are scratching at the surface. We are making a difference to thousands of people when the current energy bills, the current cost of living crisis affect millions.
Kirsty, you mentioned homelessness and the need for more data.
Yes, it's something that we're keen to see, is just a better traceability through the systems of what happens to people and why does it happen. So in terms of looking at things like the Prevent One that gets filled in relation to why are people making homeless applications, it talks about things like somebody was asked to leave their accommodation, their tenancy was terminated, there's a big kind of other, but there's nothing about rent arrears. And then there's nothing about what might the cause of rent arrears have been. And that's something that we are quite keen to capture, because if you know what the cause is, you might be able to do something further upstream to prevent it. Can we follow some of these people through and find out what's happening so we can put in interventions to try and stop things happening in the first place?
Yeah, I think I'd support that. And I think that the loss of the score data in Scotland has been, you know, detrimental to us understanding circumstances of lots of people going through the system. And more widely, actually, on homelessness, we just need to get a bit better and a bit more savvy at data. And the point Kirsty made there is about kind of tackling things upstream. Anybody who's heard John Sparks speak, former chief exec of Crisis on Homelessness, talks about this a lot. That narrative that anybody can suffer from homelessness is actually fairly flawed. And if we use data on people's circumstances, on people's educational backgrounds, on people's family backgrounds, then we can be much more targeted in terms of the preventative action that we can take. And we don't do anywhere near enough of that. And I mean that across all of public services.
If there was one policy initiative which you would like either the Scottish Government or the UK Government to take this year, what would it be? Something simple, and we'll end on this note.
I don't know if this is simple, but I think we talked a lot about response to poverty today, and we need to talk much more about prevention. And I think the one thing that, and this is difficult, this is long term, it's not going to make a difference overnight, but the one thing that would really make a difference to poverty in Scotland is significant capital investment in the energy efficiency of homes. Because of the savings that would make on people's fuel bills, the jobs it would create, good, well-paid jobs it would create, and the investment in terms of people's kind of well-being and overall health, in terms of tackling poverty, that would be enormous. And I think as a housing sector, we probably need to talk much more in those terms sometimes about why we need that investment.
Well, the Scottish Government is putting £33 billion in, it would appear, or they estimate at least that that's the cost. That's what's going to have to be spent. I know that some people think that might not actually be enough, but still, at least there's maybe some hope that you might get your wish to some extent. What about you, Kirsty?
I think my wish is more about the recognition of the links between things like social security and housing. That in Scottish Government, we will work with the Housing Directorate, but up until recently, that's been quite separate from the Social Security Directorate. And I think that we need to see much more of a link and much more of kind of closer working and understanding that in things like the Housing to 2040. Social Security wasn't mentioned very often in the consultation document, and it should be mentioned much more. And it sounds like a wee thing, but actually the more that we work together, I think Anne was talking, collaboration is key. And that's right from on the front line and local services right up to national government as well.
And that brings us to the end of the 11th episode of the Scottish Housing News podcast. So I want to thank my co-host Kieran Finlay, the editor of the Scottish Housing News. I want to thank Aaron Hill, the Director of Policy and Membership at the Scottish Federation of Housing Associations, and to thank Kirsty McKechnie, Early Warning System Project Manager at the Child Poverty Action Group Scotland. We'll be back in 2 weeks.